Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Bass Guitar Nerds, a podcast by guitar nerds. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Naomi McLeod.
Hello.
JD Short.
Hi.
And Mark Packham.
We just talk about P basses, right?
You are absolutely going to be the odd one out on
Why did you invite me to this?
Because you're a bass player. In fact, I mean, it's not okay that we've been doing this for nearly seven years. Is it 7 years now, Mark?
Something like that, yeah.
It's 7 years.
No, it's not that at all. It's not 6 years. 2015?
You're just counting guitar nerds rather than
Yeah, all in. Yeah, 7 years.
7 years, and we have never done a solely bass-based episode, even though 3 out of the 4 original guitar nerds hosts are bass players as a primary. So, you know, it's about time.
How much stuff is there to talk about, really?
Well, exactly. I wanted to have you on very much as the foil to everyone else's flamboyance, with your, you know, with your sort of relatively set in your ways.
My old man set up, basically. Yeah, P-bass exactly. Straight into the amp, no messing around.
Oh, that's horrible. He doesn't even use a tuner, guys. It's terrible.
It's but true. Anyway. Whoa. I don't need to. The sets that I play are generally 15 to 20 minutes, so it's not going to P-bass is not going to have a tune in 15 minutes, is it?
This is the issue with punk rock. But yes, welcome, dear listener. Welcome to the first episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds. Obviously, we have 2 new hosts for you here. We've got Naomi and JD. Listeners who have been listening for a long time, you might remember we had JD on an episode like 2 years ago when we were doing the NAMM specials back in 2018, but we've never had Naomi on a podcast before. So very much this episode, we're going to be, you know, I think, listener, you need to get to know our hosts and where everyone stands in the world of bass guitars, you know, in the sense that you know that J. Cross is going to just care about Baja Telecasters and Blues Juniors, and that, you know, Mark just cares about Gibson Juniors. You know, there's everyone is set in their ways, and we need to explore our new hosts and the sort of things they're into. So welcome, JD and Naomi. Thank you very much for being a part of the first episode.
Glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes.
What are you doing, Joe, to kick off? Are we doing some sort of, you know, secret origin story to find out how people got started and what they play?
That sounds like a great idea. Yeah, I was thinking we should all just talk about, like, maybe we'll look at, like, basses first, you know. I'm not going to plan too far ahead, because every time I plan far ahead on the regular episode, we get about, you know, a sort of a quarter of the way through anything that I've said we're going to cover. So I guess for starters, I'll introduce both of our hosts, and then we'll talk about the basses they play. So JD is obviously endorsed by endorsed by Stonefield Basses, the same bass brand that I have a bass guitar with, and JD performs as bass doubler, where he kind of approaches bass in a really, like, melodic lead way. So he has some really interesting sort of tonal ways of doing things. So, you know, so I want to talk a lot about the Stonefield stuff with JD because that's going to be super cool. And Naomi has worked in guitar retail for a long, long time and has some absolutely fantastic basses and has done a really good job of making one particular very affordable bass into something extraordinarily cool. So I guess if we're going to talk about basses first, JD, why don't we start? Why don't we start with you? You're currently your main bass is the Stonefield, but of course you've had mad things. You've had basses with vibrato systems.
Yeah. I had that was early 2000s Carvin LB20 four string that was all mahogany. Mahogany neck through body with a custom Kaler-esque vibrato system installed on it with which is super thin and super lightweight bass, and which is pretty much against everything that I have on all of my other basses. I just, you know, usually quite heavy or quite beefy sounding, but yeah, it was great. I got on that bass too. I had some of the early Nordstrand Warm and Woolly big blades that Kerry came out with. I got some of those before they were I guess technically out for the public. So
I guess
it was
when you lived in the States, he would have been quite local to you.
Yeah. Kerry is just down the street from where I was. I used to sort of Southern California desert. So Kerry's just in Redlands, California. So I was able to just pop over to his, you know, shop and grab a couple of those and chuck them in before NAMM or before one of the Bass Guitar Lives, which was the bass player version of the London Bass Guitar Show, one of the magazine put on sort of trade shows.
Yeah. Did it work? Did the Trem system actually work? Because, you know, it doesn't work on a Bass 6.
Yeah. No, it was an excellent system. It had locking tuners, and it was full floating, so it was up and down. The bass was just a really good sounding passive four string, but yeah, I ended up shifting that on not too long ago. So right. Mostly just because I'm only playing Stonefield stuff at the moment, really, anyway. So I was just noticing I wasn't picking up anything else anymore. So yeah, that was.
And the Stonefield you've got quite a different one from me, because I've got the M series classic, which is there, which I guess is the basses that they started making, which are tuned from the bridge, so they still have their headstock, but you've got the Stanley tuning system on the bridge and the single pickup in the middle of the body with the full passive tone shaping. But yours is you went for an did you go for an F series?
Yes. Well, I actually have two. So I have the M series, sort of like yours, which is the sort of the top of the line. Like, I think that's sort of the full Stonefield experience of things. And then
they are $4,200.
Yeah, I would happily pay that again for mine. Like, it's kicked. Like, honestly, like, it's the best bass I've ever played. And I have another custom that is like somewhat close to it that we can talk about later, but it beats my old Alembic and everything else. Like, it's that tone I'm the happiest with that I've ever had on my M series. But the bass you're referring to is I started with the F series, which is their entry level basses that are made offshore in India as opposed to New Zealand. And it's a bolt-on neck, it's got standard headstock tuners, and then it's just walnut, alder body, and maple neck. So pretty classic bass you'd see anywhere, but it's got the Stonefield body, the the neck adjustment, sort of the back angle that you can get on those as well, and also like wooden bridge. I upgraded mine to the Tom Stanley tuning system. So it's got the tuners at the bridge. So the aluminium bridge and everything for lightweight. And then you can do the fine tuning. So, yeah, fine tuning at the bridge. And then also just have the standard headstock tuners, which I use quite a bit. And I like that one I like that one a lot. I really enjoyed it, but doing so much stuff with Tom and just like constantly playing the M series is sort of one of those things that it was just calling to me, you know.
Yeah, so. there's such different neck profiles as well, the F series to the M, because very much Tom Stanley and Stonefield have introduced the F series is you know, whilst they're still $1,000 for an instrument, this is the entry level for Stonefield, and there it's very much an accessible neck profile, whereas Stonefields are kind of known for, they're incredibly playable, but it doesn't make sense that they are, because the necks are colossal.
Yeah, it's like everything when someone talks about wanting like a big beefy neck, like a C profile or something on like any Fender, and just kind of chuckle a bit when you're like, well, try this. And I think I have to count again, but I think my neck has 42 laminates. I think it's 40, just the way Tom builds everything. Yeah. So it's massive. And actually the bass I have now is the one that was in one of the issues of Bass Guitarist. So they reviewed it, and then I ended up with that actual bass.
Oh,
so.
Awesome. What top wood did you get on that then? Is it one of the ebony or walnut ones?
No. So it is, it's one of the South Asian timbers. I'd have to look it up, because there are a lot of, you know, one of the things that Stonefield does is use local woods to them that aren't the traditionally sourced woods that you'd see. So it's all pretty good. But yeah, the one I have, I don't know if you've seen, if you remember seeing it, but it's the one that has the big knot like on the top, so just above the base side of the bridge. It's got like this big gnarly basically
I remember
like
this
chunk out of it. Yes, it's
pretty looks
good.
It looks incredible. That's kind of the great thing about the Stonefields. Like the one I've got, the top wood's Australian blackwood, the fingerboard is Sobrano, and then you know the like you've got sort of the all of the hardware is made out of Solomon ebony. Like he really goes out of his way to, and that really is where the cost comes in with the Stonefield basses, is that everything is made out of a premium piece of wood. And you see where like Tom Stanley lives, he's just surrounded by all this New Zealand forest land, you know, where he can source this incredible stuff from. So it's very cool.
Can I jump in and say three things about Stonefield?
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, because I never listened to you, Joe, I'd completely forgotten or didn't know that they do the F series, which are actually, you know, affordable basses. You've definitely told me this, and I just don't listen to you, so it had gone out of my brain. They look super cool, again, for, you know, for not a lot of money. Well, for, you know, it's a reasonable amount of money, but considering the prices of their, you know, their fully fledged series, it's a really affordable way to get into the series, and they look cool. And like you say, for most players, it seems like the neck profile will be more like what they're used to. So they look really cool, and I'd completely forgotten that you had told us that they existed. The other thing, so I'm on their website right now. I like that they've got bass guitars as a category, and the next category is not bass guitars. which
it's a nice touch.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's all the other stuff they do: strings, cabs, signal processors, that sort of thing. But also looking at their list of players, you two are both there, and I'd never thought, well, in fact, I never want to see this again. I go to the player list and Joe Brandon is smack bang in the middle, and that is that's upsetting to me, and it should be for everyone.
I know. I tell you what, I've never tried the Stonefield, their Mighty Mini cabs. They look absolutely fantastic. I thought that was such an odd thing to go for. When you think a Stonefield is like a, what is it, like a 36-inch scale neck?
Yeah,
like they are, Stonefields are, like Tom Stanley, the guy who makes them, must be 6 foot six.
Yeah.
And he makes them for him. And I'm 5 foot eight. And I am dwarfed by the Stonefield bass. And so I'm very surprised when he moved into cabs, he's made these tiny little 6.5-inch cabinets.
Yeah.
In great colors.
Yeah, that's the colors are bonkers on those two, which is great. And like I've got one that is in the, so they're little cabinets. He did a coating on them that's basically like the coatings you would get from like a utility truck, like the bed of a utility truck, but it sort of has a little bit of rubber to it. So they're supposed to be like all weather cabs and everything too. But they're in like if you look at the Stonefield stuff and everything, so like timber forward, you know, you see the woods and you see all the like the wood grain and that's the aesthetic, and then the cabs are like bright pink and bright blue.
Yeah, it's very bright yellow. Weird.
Yeah, it's great. I had Tom do a special one for me that is, I have one of the Mighty Minis, which is the smallest ones, that is in the like electric teal sort of blue color with a hot pink grill, which is like super, super Art Deco-y, which is just great. Part of that is like Tom, I just chatting with Tom, and he started building cabinets when he was, you know, like a lot of the builders, you know, we look up to today. It's just like, well, they didn't have what I wanted, so I made it, which is the same way he's built bases. But he's built cabinets back when he was playing, you know, shows around Florida and when he lived in the States and everything like that. So yeah, it was, that's kind of like back to the roots. And yeah, but I'm with you too. Like I was kind of like, oh, you're building cabinets. Cool. Seems weird.
Yeah, it was pretty random. I remember, I think at NAMM when you just started doing stuff with Stonefield, mm-hmm. you were demoing his first pedals, which were essentially a tone shaping pedal in the same style. So Naomi and Mark, I don't know if you know this about Stonefield basses, but they're passive, but they have a complete cut based tonal range of controls. So you
didn't
have
that, no. That's, yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, it means that, you know, of course you're not using anything that requires batteries, but you do have an alarming amount of tone shaping. And I don't use the master tone or the bass cut that's on there. Or I guess the master tone is kind of a treble cut, isn't it? A treble cut or a bass cut. So I don't use either of those. But the other option is a notched a sort of a mid shift, essentially switching your mid focus from pointed to scooped as you roll through. But he made a pedal that was just that you were kind of using for stuff.
Yeah, and it's well, and part of that was with the F series, like they don't have that advanced electronics in them. They're basically volume tone, like you would see in, you know, a lot of other basses, but it was a way to sort of get there's two versions. There's a rack mount version these are still in prototypes. There's a rack mount version that has the full like 10 plus mid-range notches that you can get just on the basses, the M series that Joe and I have. But then there was a pedal, which was basically, it had eight different ones, and we were, you know, at that NAMM show, we were playing through and trying to see like which ones we wanted to put there. And then there's a couple other things Tom's working on in the same sort of vein that this last NAMM show, the January 2020 NAMM show before, you know, everything became the way things are now.
I don't remember that time.
Yeah, yeah.
cannot remember like, the before times.
Yeah, it was.
Remember gigs?
Yeah.
Vaguely.
No, actually.
Yeah, it was crazy because we were sat right next to the Earthquaker booth, which is great anyway, just for me. We were just like, they kept coming over and we kept just going through like each other's stuff like constantly over the few days, and it was really cool. And just having like seeing them, you know, like some of their, you know, like designers, and just kind of look and be like, I'm not really sure how this works. And, you know, same thing, like we've had it with, you know, other people in the industry who are, you know, design preamps for other big manufacturers, are just being like, I don't understand how any of this works. Like, it doesn't make any sense that it's all passive. And also everyone's always like, why passive? You know, and so it's a weird, quirky thing. I mean, I have reasons for it, but that'll take up another 20 minutes. So.
I'm super glad that it's passive. I don't think I'd have got on board with Stonefield if it had been active, because I still can't sort of deal with active stuff. Like it's too much of an extra thing to think about for me. I'm going to be too drunk by the time a set is finished to remember to unplug things, and I like keeping it simple.
I also just want to point out that, you know, we're talking, we were giving, you know, Mark grief about a P-bass, and then in essence, we're just playing really fancy like modern versions, versions of like single pickup passive electronics.
Totally,
like you're out like, there, like you know,
shouting about passive tone controls. I'll tell you what's got the ultimate passive tone control. It's all that you know. They managed to fit it into like one control as well. It's you know, it's bonkers. So
yeah,
it all comes back to that best feat of engineering in the 20th century. The Fender Precision Bass.
Yes. Yeah. Well, speaking of kind of Fender basses, and this is great. I love that we're going to go from kind of from the sort of 4.5 grand sort of modern Stonefields to talking about one of the coolest basses, retro style basses that I've ever seen, which is something that Naomi's put together. You went down a completely different track. By sort of making your own kind of bass.
Backwards track, upside down track, whatever way you want to put it. Financially reductive.
Now, you've played lots of different basses, but you tend to err on the sort of... You can see, listener, I've chosen people who are going to also like traditional Fender basses because I definitely... And everyone here's a four-string player as well, which so I'm sorry, listener, bass nerds, if you were expecting anything else, but no, I've stuck with people who have taste in basses. Let's talk about your incredible bass that you're using at the moment.
I actually play a five-string as well, you know.
God damn it!
Not sorry if I've ruined the episode.
Just shut this podcast down now.
Yeah. the one you're referring to, of course, is my Squire Bronco mod project that I took on about a year or so ago. So, having worked in stores for many years, as well as playing in bands, recording bands. And just generally being a lover of all things gear. Like many people, the short scale style has long been something that has kind of caught my attention, both sonically and in every other sense. I really enjoy the feel of smaller, shorter neck, and really enjoy what you can achieve tonally. So obviously, due to that, I've played and loved many Mustangs of many different eras. But the strange and cheap little gem that just kept falling into my hands many's a time working in stores was, in fact, the Squire Bronco.
Incredibly affordable. They're like £130, something like that.
Something they've always sat under the kind of 200 mark in the time I've worked with them. But no doubt they've come down even further now. So.
I don't know why Squire renamed them, like, because of course the Bronco was a guitar that Fender made in the 60s, which was the Music Master, but with a pickup in the bridge rather than in the neck. And I think the Bronco was full scale rather than being short scale. But this is a Music Master, just a modern Music Master made by Squire, because it's right that even the pickup is still a Strat pickup in the basic Bronco.
Yes. That is it, just with a little white cover. But basically, I couldn't help but notice that time and time again, basically the Broncos that were coming through the store I was working in just had these killer necks. And eventually I thought this, like I would be an idiot not to explore this as some sort of little mod project. So unsurprisingly, one came in, had a super nice neck. I picked it up and was doodling around a bit at home, thinking, what should I pop in here? So the hardware, of course, was the first thing that I chose to kind of sort out. So I went with some Hipshot ultralights, managed to get some Lollipop tuners.
Yes,
super tasty. Would be rude not to. So those popped on there, and in the meantime, had been lucky to play. So Tim Lefebvre came through and did a masterclass at the store I was at.
Oh, and, awesome.
Yeah, and he was rocking the first I had seen of Serac basses. So he was playing a Midwestern, I believe, was the model.
The Midwestern's the one, isn't it? That's their short scale version.
Yeah. Now Jake Serac does, I think he does, I think four out of his five models are short scale. But he's I mean, he's really kind of increasing his and broadening his range and offerings as he goes. But primarily he is sort of known, I guess, as a short scale builder. But so I went up to Tim after an excellent masterclass that he gave, and I said, is there any chance I could just play this fascinating looking bass? You know, it looked like Silvertone and a P bass and an EBO. It had some sort of very strange little baby that sounded awesome. And yeah, so got asking him about the pickup, and it was Sarek's own hand-wound B90 pickup that was in there. So after a short amount of Googling, I see Sarek sells the B90 on its own, and it made a total no-brainer as an addition to the Bronco project. I mean, I think Jake Sarek had one demo up on YouTube, and it just sounds absolutely awesome.
Oh, it's fantastic. I can't believe he's kind of the first person to think about making a pickup in this style.
I know, right? Like, I like, just like you say, like, I went looking around after hearing this demo thinking, surely this has been done before, but seemingly not in any kind of as prominent way as the B90 design.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super. Just the idea of a bass pickup in a P90 housing seems like the sort of thing that should have been an industry standard a long time ago.
For sure, yeah.
They're only available in the States off of his website. I thought, but you told me recently that they actually ship worldwide and stuff, which I was not aware of.
Yeah. So from now, he has more recently set up a web store of his own, but through I believe through Reverb. Reverb was where I found his store initially and was able to get one of the B90s from there. But it's gotten compliments almost every gig I've played with it. A lot of people asked about it, and obviously not that many people have used them as mods in non-Sarek bases just yet, so it's still somewhat new to the market, and I would not be surprised if it makes a lasting impression in the coming years, because I cannot get enough of it. I cannot think of enough future bases of mine that I would like to put a B90 into as well.
It just looks great as well. Like, you know, Guitar Nerd's known for coming back to how things look rather than how they sound as a major flaw in this podcast. But like, the pickup itself just looks really good. And yeah, I'm just looking at the picture of this Bronco right now. And yeah, that and the Torque Guard, they go together really well.
Yeah. So the Torque Guard, I guess you had to have custom cut for this as well.
The Torque Guard, I got very lucky. I searched an awful lot through pick guard makers, both in the States and in the UK, because I had grand ideas of materials and stuff like that. But as an incredibly impatient person, they all involved sending off the pick guard for a template to be created and all that sort of stuff. So I got very lucky on eBay and found someone who actually does have a cut and a template for Bronco pickguards, and picked up the Torque there. So that was kind of another lucky find. So really the mods on that particular bass just kind of came together surprisingly easy. And again, as a first mod project for me, it suited me perfectly that I suppose beyond immediate personal taste, I didn't have to go on too many big long searches to kind of get what I wanted.
Yeah. And you took it down to its bare finish as well, this bass.
Yes, that's the piece that I did. I don't care to mention on this podcast what tools I used to definish that bass, but
I want to hear that the description of that. Let's do it.
I would say do not try this at home if your bass costs anything more than £130 retail, let's say.
You know, the ultimate way to get rid of poly finishes, which I learned off of a fellow that me and Mark used to work with in GAC, is a heat gun.
Yes, indeed.
I didn't realise how much that works.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have spent hours sanding
chipping away.
Finish. Yeah.
How did you do it then, Naomi? I'm very curious to know.
I chiseled and sanded, if I remember correctly.
The Joe Brandon method, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
That must have taken you weeks.
It took quite a while, and somewhere in my home in Dublin, there are many tiny chips of polyfinish in in the floor, in the walls, possibly in my hair. Over a year later, we'll never know. But it was a completely DIY job on the finish. I actually was a little worried that with the heat method, a few people who had carried out the heat method had kind of reported that if you're unlucky or whatever, polyfinish has been used, that you can sometimes get staining. And the last thing I wanted was to have any sort of black stain in the wood finish.
I guess if you're not planning to refinish it afterwards, that is quite a risk.
Exactly. And in the case of this particular mod, I knew I wanted sort of that aged natural sort of look. So I kept it as simple and sort of paint free as possible, and ended up with sort of a dark ash sort of stain.
Yeah, actually, more or less a finish that Fender have just brought out as a limited edition color option with that plate in the Mustang. The player Mustang. It used to be the offset Mustang. Now it's the player Mustang. Yeah,
yeah.
They're doing that now. Aged natural with the torque guard.
Yeah, I know. I had a good chuckle at that when I saw that on the Fender website.
Someone's been taking notice.
Yeah.
The pickup in that guitar is more expensive than the guitar in that guitar.
In
your Bronco?
Yes, it is. again, quite proud of my first mod involving parts that cost more than the instrument itself.
That's very good. You can hear that bass. I think I saw it in a live session that you did with I don't know how to pronounce it. Is it Uli or
Uli? Yes, Uli. Right, okay. So Uli's an amazing sort of lo-fi R&B artist from Dublin. He's a recently new project of maybe the last 2 years or so. So, yeah, I played on a few live sessions with him, and I'll make sure that you guys have the link so people can have a listen if they like. I am still planning doing kind of a proper demo of the B90 as well.
I thought it sounded fantastic in those sessions. Like, you really, when you think about, you know, as you say, this was kind of like a lo-fi R&B, very sort of soul-esque.
Yeah.
That is not what I expect someone to be playing, a sort of a Music Master, you know, a Bronco style bass. When you think of that, those sort of tones, I think I don't expect a short scale to be doing anything that kind of, I guess, clean and funky, but it sounds fantastic. Like the clarity on your Bronco is wonderful on that session. Like, when you think that it's a £150 bass, it's, you know, it sounds clean and perfect enough for R&B, which is quite a high bar.
Sure. Well, this is the thing. I mean, it was not that it was a surprise to me. I mean, I knew I wanted a short scale project with a really cool pickup and with decent hardware. And so, you know, once that was achieved, obviously, there's always an element of chance with any mod, I suppose, isn't there? Because it's a particular body and a particular pickup and other particular parts that maybe haven't met before in a way that you've heard. But yeah, what it managed to produce was a super versatile short scale model, and I would love to hear more of them.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned, We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
More kind of B90 mods in future, for sure. I mean, with that particular base, I ended up playing because I work when there are gigs and when there are sessions. I work as a gigging session player as well. I toured that base with a super loud noise rock band and again got many compliments on the tone through fuzz, through distortion, through whatever else. So yeah.
That's a real testament to the pickup. Ceric basses have really only just... I appreciate American listeners, which is, you know, the bulk of you, to be honest. But I appreciate you've had Ceric basses available there for quite some time, but they've only just really made their way over to the UK. And you can get them in... I think Bass Gallery might be the only place stocking them at the moment. I'm not sure. Maybe Bass Direct are as well, I think, in the UK. But...
It's mostly like a custom thing though, right? You can order like different colors and stuff if you order.
Oh yeah, of course, it's a complete custom shop. But I tell you what, Bass Gallery, who always have the best taste when they're ordering in, who also stock Stonefield, but when Bass Gallery order in custom stuff, it always seems to be like there is someone there who has wonderful taste. And the first thing they had in from Ceric was a Midwestern, which is the one we're talking about, which is your what do you call it, what's the body shape it's based on, the Epiphone Coronet, there we go. It was a Midwestern in like a through grain black, so a mahogany body where you've got that like that tight grain that the black is just saturating into with a torque guard. I think it was a B90, but it might not have been, because they also do these other sort of big Gretsch-style pickups. And it, you know, it went in. They're only, I can't remember what they are, £1,600. Like, they are not a lot for custom shop instruments.
I'm just looking right now. Literally, while we're talking, I'm specking one out.
It went in a day. it went in a day on Bass Gallery, this Ceric. Like, I saw it come in, because I look at Bass Gallery most mornings. My life isn't that interesting. But it was gone the next day, because I was thinking about it. I was like, well, if there's one here and I don't have to pay import on it, then actually this is a great option.
They all basically, just looking at the Ceric website now, they're all basically $2,000 roughly, depending on, you know, what upgrades and stuff you want. But yeah, I mean, pretty much any of the body shapes that I can see are... about that sort of money. I actually call it the Armitage.
The Armitage is cool. The Armitage, isn't that the one that's more like a Gibson Ripper?
That's no, the that is the scale, yeah.
That's the Lincoln.
That's the Lincoln.
Right.
The Armitage is more like Ricky 3001. Don't know if you guys know that bass. It's I think a bolt-on guitar that Ricky did in the 70s, I want
to
say.
JD used to work for Rick and Becker.
Yeah.
Case, you definitely know this bass. Do you want to give the history on it?
No, you go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's about all I know. All I know is it's a bolt-on. There's the 3000 was the short scale one. The 3001 was the long scale one. It's like just a less fancy Ricky, I guess.
Yeah, and then I think it, in essence, I mean, well, this isn't factually correct, but it's sort of, that became like the Cheyenne, which is their model that seems very un-Rickenbacker, where it's just a wood bass that's made, you know, it's basically like an 80s bass, but made by Rickenbacker kind of thing. Yeah. But
yeah, the 3000 like always seemed like a kind of stripped back thing to me. You know, it was like completely different body shape, didn't have all the fancy stuff to it. Bolt on. As far as I'm aware, they're bolt on. I'll double check that, but you might know more than me. But I just like them because loads of like punk bass players pick them up, and I think you can get them. I mean, they're very, very rare, but you can get them when you find them very, very cheaply compared to similar age, you know, 4001s or whatever. So, so that's why I like the Armitage. I think that looks super cool because it's very much in that vein.
So, for me, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the Armitage is the only one of the five models that is that comes long scale as standard.
Really?
As
well. Right.
Yeah, that's a 34 as standard, and I'm pretty sure the other four are they're 30 inches standard with 32 and 34 options in some.
I see.
It's kind of the beauty of the custom shop element, isn't it?
What's amazing to me, looking at the Armitage, and in fact I think it applies to all of them, is that one of the options is body wood. And like for me, you know, when you're, you know, I go to, like, you know, going back to the guitar side of things, you know, I go to a Les Paul because it's a mahogany body. I wouldn't necessarily want that as an option to be like, oh, actually, I want to change the body wood to maple. So yeah, it seems weird to me that, you know, the options that you've got on these bases are so fluid that to the point where you can basically change the complete nature of the base by changing the body wood, you know.
Well, yeah. I think that's one of the key differences between bass and guitar broadly, like as far as like what's available, and just in the sense that, you know, like the tonal nature of and the way that the strings interact with a bass is much different than it is with a guitar, where, you know, and there's much more history where, you know, just what you're saying is like, if you think about Les Paul, you think mahogany, I'm going to go for that style tone. Like it's, and you start seeing like variations on a Les Paul theme, whereas like basses, certainly in boutique builds and certainly in that, it's sort of, you tend to have fewer basses, or you want a bass that can do more things. Like you want a bass that works in a punky set with a lot of fuzz, and also in an R&B set, and then also with everything else, as opposed to having, you know, like 12 guitars that sort of, well, this is my guitar with that I use with this specific preamp, potentially, is sort of like how I sort of see it, and the way I've always sort of seen like boutique builds go that way, is it's sort of, you know, you tend to have one thing and just sit with it.
I feel like that's always been the way on bass, you know. I kind of feel like, you know, let's say, you know, following the timeline of guitars, it's like, you know, 50s, you get the Tele, you know, and there's Paul, and then you get Strat. And I kind of feel like there was small iterations on that stuff all the way up to, you know, like the 80s, getting the Ibanez RG is basically a kind of a Strat evolved. Whereas bass, it was like, okay, we've done the P bass and the jazz bass, right? People are just going to play those for like 10 years. Oh, and then suddenly Alembic is there with like active preamp, you know, like through neck, kind of totally different body shape. I just feel like the jumps in bass design have always been much bigger than they have on the guitar side of things, if that makes sense.
But I think the feel of basses is much bigger than it is with guitar. Certainly playing like a Strat or playing a Les Paul, those are two very different feeling instruments, but not nearly to the extent, like you're talking about an inch scale length difference, you know. There is 4 inches between an SG bass and a P bass. You know, if it's a different type of instrument, there's such a broad spectrum in basses that I think, I guess, I don't know why, but, you know, obviously the P bass and the jazz bass really saturated the market. The sad thing for me is that short scale bass has got such a hard rap. You know, the SG bass, you can pick up a Gibson EB3 from 1969 for like £1,600. Why should you be able to pick up a 60s bass by one of the biggest companies in the world for that little money, where it cost me 10 grand for, you know, a P bass of the same year? Well, not quite 10 grand, but for a P bass of the same year.
It's a modern tragedy, Joe.
Yeah. I know. And as a big advocate for short scale basses, you know, as well as obviously playing literally the opposite thing in a 36 inch scale Stonefield. But I have no idea why short scale basses didn't have more impact than they did. I think it is mainly down to the fact that the P bass and the jazz bass were just so good. And I think when music changed, Fender guitars had an appropriate tonal range to deal with how music progressed, and Gibson basses just didn't. They had this one sound that went massively out of fashion. People started wanting clarity in basses, and that was not something that short scale basses with mud buckers could offer. And so all of a sudden it just became, you know, You either played a Fender or an Active Instrument.
Yeah, and I think we'd have to look at the same time that that's when bass amplification became viable. You know, was right when Ampeg came out with, you know, the SVT, and, you know, instead of just seeing like B15s and stuff like that, like you could, when you could actually, when playing a non-short scale bass, electric bass, made a difference and it could be amplified, then you could go on to play other things. And that's why we weren't just, you know, like we as bass players weren't just playing like the tic-tac lines that you would get, you know, like for a bass six on top of the upright that was there just for the radio and yeah. and that kind of stuff. So it's like the bass amplification happened at the same, like that, you know, like late 60s, early 70s at this, you know, made the same jump that Alembic came out when you were running through bespoke PAs and everything. You know, like the Grateful Dead, love them or, you know, well, how I feel. Them. Yeah. musically, I don't, but for, you know, just what they've done for like the audio industry, you know, alone, just, you know, creating, you know, like a marketplace for Alembics and Rick Turner, you know, to be able to do stuff and all of the PA system and just what they've done with preamps and effects units and putting a Mutron out there that wasn't just on a funk tune and sort of all that stuff. Like, it's just fascinating to look at.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you're right in a sense that's something that we have to consider. It's not just the basses, it's the amplifiers. If you consider the fact that by the time Fender were releasing the jazz bass, Paul McCartney was still playing through a 50-watt amp in stadiums. You know, no one could hear that. It was a real kind of late revelation, I guess, that we moved to amplifiers that could actually articulate the instrument that was being played through them.
What year did SVT come out?
69, right? I think.
Yeah, 1969. You're right. So yeah, Beatles were like basically. I mean, obviously they weren't gigging at that point, but yeah, I do think that is like a massive shift and improvements in PA as well. I guess started to happen around that time.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so. Okay, so speaking of amplifiers, just we're coming to the end of this episode, which has been wonderful. But speaking of amplifiers, Mark, obviously you're playing an old.
I'm playing nothing 30? Right now. I don't think anyone's playing particularly like massive bass amplifiers at the moment. To be honest, I couldn't even tell you where my bass amp is. I think it's at Jay's house. Right. Jay being one of the other podcast hosts for JD and Naomi. I haven't used it at all this year, and I used it very sparsely last year. I kind of feel like. Yeah, it must be really tough. If you make big, loud amps right now, you must be hurting because, you know, why would people be buying 300-watt bass heads right now or more? So, Mark Bass, original Little Mark head. For me, one of the best bass amps ever made. They've got the perfect fusion of something that still sounds kind of aggressive because they're not a D-class power amp, they're just a regular solid state power amp.
That is only the first series they did.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that. Yeah, yeah. Little Mark 1. The ones that are in the yellow box rather than the black box with the yellow writing. But they're still, you know, they're much heavier than the later Little Marks, but they're still light enough that you can sort of carry them with one hand. And as for someone who before that had an Ampeg B2 combo, which was essentially an SVT 350 in a 15-watt combo.
I remember.
That was quite a big, or maybe it was a B3, I can't remember. Anyway, it was essentially that in a combo, and it was massive and it was heavy. To switch to the Little Mark head was an absolute revelation.
Yeah, yeah, I bet. Naomi, you used to play Aguilar, right?
I still do. Yeah.
Oh, you still do, right?
Yeah, I'm an Aguilar gal through and through.
Is it supposed to be Aguilar? I'm never sure. Should we all agree on a pronunciation?
Aguilar. It's Aguilar.
Aguilar.
Well, I mean,
not Aguilar.
That's how Stephen pronounces it.
right.
Wait, okay, which? Fine. Which? Aguilar or
no,
Aguilar?
No, Aguilar.
Aguilar. Okay, fine, cool. Fine. Okay, let's not go down the Moog Moog.
Well,
war
also,
zone.
I mean, his name was Moog, so there's an answer.
Yeah, as I was saying, let's not go down that route. So, yes, to answer your question, Joe, I started with a Tonehammer 500 many years ago, possibly as far back as 2013, I think. And at the time, I had two SL112s, which I sold on like a fool because they were beautiful little cabs.
Oh, why did you do that? There were such great cabs.
They were super, and they were light, and they did what they said on the tin. They were
and
super
so
light.
Expensive though.
I know. But yeah, stunning cabs, and it was something really silly. It was like the band I was playing in at the time required just something bigger and heftier, and obviously the 112s, you know, were super for everything, but perhaps not the grunge that I was playing at the time.
What finish were they in the
They were the classic. They were the black and silver, right. Classic. I didn't get my mitts on. What were they doing at the time? I think they were doing the chocolate finish at the time.
Yeah, they've done them in like a vintage white with a red grill since then as well.
Yeah, that was the one. But yeah, so loved and enjoyed those for many years. And then for certain kind of little smaller gigs, more recently I picked up a Mark Bass 210. What was the model?
Is it one of the combos or is it just the
No,
cab?
No,
cab. It was the cab. It was
so it's either the New York or the Traveller, I think.
Yeah, it was the Traveller 210. Yeah. Traveller 210P, I think.
Really good, really lightweight. They actually sound excellent. I prefer their cabs to their heads, to be honest. But you know, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be in the same ballpark with that. But as a cab and as a light cab for lugging around from gig to gig, it was superb. So yeah, I currently am cabless. Actually, I'm between cabs, but I'm rocking an AG 700 these days, headwise. So that was my.
Wait, the 700, is that the big valve one?
It's not. That's the DB 750 or 751. So the AG is basically, it's, I believe, the next step up from the Tonehammer series. And it's essentially a slightly beefier, bulkier, ever so slightly more clear and dynamic head to the Tonehammer series. But yeah, I'm a huge fan. It has one of my only requests on any head that I use is a super flexible EQ. So I like, just depending on the room that I'm playing in, I really like to have a super strong cut and boost on the most basic, like 3 or 4 band EQs. And it has that. It has a 4 band. So you have treble, high mid, low mid, bass. And additional to that, there is... It doesn't have the built-in drive that the Tonehammer had. And that's probably the one thing I miss. I did use...
Oh, really? Did you find yourself using that? I could never see myself using a drive that you can't turn on and off.
Yeah, well, it's pretty contentious. But I mean, obviously it's project or context dependent, right?
Of course,
so
yeah.
this was in a band where I kind of had a perma distortion tone. And it was it was superb for that. Obviously, I eventually just got the aggro, which I think had the same circuit, actually, same drive circuit as the Tonehammer drive. And that did give me the on off. But I've kept the aggro and moved on from the Tonehammer head.
Right. Of course. Yeah. Super cool. A super cool head. The AG 700. Very wicked.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it is pretty modern, you know. It is solid
it's
state.
Kind of a halfway house with Aguilar. We agreed on that pronunciation. Yeah, I kind of feel like they're a halfway house. So I'm you know a sort of a terrible traditionalist in that I hate everything Class D. Even the suggestion that something should be lightweight is ridiculous to me, because surely what you should be caring about is how something sounds. And so when companies release small heads, I'm like, this is not a thing that I care about. I care about it sounding good.
Sure.
But that said, I always thought Aguilar did a great job of actually making these modern rigs that sounded traditional. They sounded like Ampex to me. You know, you could actually make them sound old school. Mark Base definitely had that option because they had the, I don't know if they had them on your series, Mark, but they had a vintage loudspeaker emulator.
They didn't.
The VLE.
The one on mine is, oh no, sorry. Yes, VLE is on my one. They didn't have VPF.
VPF, but no one wants VPF because that's just a mid scoop. So yeah, unless you want to sound absolutely rubbish, you don't want that. So it was the VLE, the loudspeaker emulator, which was what I was all about, because it was essentially, they could have just called that control Jack Bruce, and then like you just turn it up for more Jack Bruce, and that made sense to me. That was a really useful control. JD, amplification.
Amplification wise, I am and have been for quite some time, like Eden amplification is what I've been playing for ages. My favorite of that is their discontinued for quite some time, but was the Metro series, which was the World Tour head in a 210 cabinet. So
they were so good.
Yeah, it was the one I had was still, was handmade and was, I think it was, it's a mid late 90s. That it's still going strong, and it was like, and I had, I've played pretty much every amp that's come out since, and it's, I just kept going back to the Eden. There's just something it does to, it's sort of the high end in the way I use high ends. I don't traditionally, like my tone's weird for a solo bassist, and it's not real, like it's not real sizzly and bright. And it's also not like quite vintage. It's just sort of present, I think.
Right.
And growly. And it's just those heads do it. And then like the Eden cabinets, I think, are really the thing that sets everything apart. Like their, their XLT cabs and the XSTs, just differences, the porting. But again, each of those were, that 210 combo was close to 100 pounds. Was built for sound and not for maneuverability up and down, like, like steps at a venue or anything. And, I mean, it was still well better. Like I used to tour 2 810s. So, I'm with you on the, like, just carrying, it sounds better. So I'm going to have 2 810s. So yeah, that was,
it doesn't sound better enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was great because I had one on each side of the stage. So,
only were you too loud for you, but you were too loud for someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure I was too loud everywhere. And there's, we were playing 1,000 plus capacity venues without go running through the PA, which I will say is one of the dumbest things I've done in my life.
So, surprised you're still able to podcast or wear headphones or hear people in any fashion.
Yeah. It comes or walk lugging around 16 speakers.
The Eden stuff, and then like now I've been playing their the Terra Nova series, which is their Class D, but the Terra Nova's the most recent version, which is was sort of based off the World Tour 550, which is sort of this like sweet spot kind of classic head. So the World Tour 800 is what everyone's had. It's what, like, if you get like a soft tube emulation and stuff, like that's what it's based on. But the WT 550 was one that like everyone who played Eden was kind of like, there's something just sort of magical about that specific head that was still like, that was a toroidal transformer back then, that the head itself was still 60 pounds, for a 500 watt head. But the Class D version of that, like, it sounds as close as a Class D will ever sound to, an actual massive transformer. But yeah,
I was really incredibly impressed with the Terra Nova series by Eden. I thought they were absolutely fantastic. As someone who's sort of naturally averse to Class D stuff, it was actually one of the one of the amplifiers that I tried and was like, this sounds really, really good. It drives quite nicely mm-hmm. as well, which I think was really kind of important and a thing that I think is lacking on a lot of Class D amplifiers. It just, you know, obviously clarity is what Class Ds kind of go for, but it had a nice amount of wooliness, which is kind of what I want.
And I think for me too, like the Eden stuff, it's like, it's a really nice platform for me because, I mean, Joe, you know, and like you've seen parts of my pedal board at least, which, you know, like at times is, you know, like I used to carry it in at least one keyboard case, depending on what I was going to go for. And it's just silly. It's six different drive pedals and stuff, you know, but, you know, like, but just having like an amp that just behaves how I want it to behave constantly was sort of what I was after too. So.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I recently changed on my last tour to using an Ashdown CTM 300. Obviously Ashdown amps are something I've used for a while and I've always used their I've always used the Ashdown ABM series, which are the series that you expect. They're the series that everyone the when you think of Ashdown,
That's the one. That's the Ashdown amp.
It's like the go-to Ashdown. Right? Yeah,
exactly. So it's that blue face chassis. It has a couple of valves in the preamp, but then a solid state power amp stage. They've introduced way more tone shaping than I need because you get three like fader tone controls in between the bass, middle and treble as well for utmost shaping, which of course I don't use at all. Plus the ABM always had, it has built in like you get a sub octave, which doesn't really work like a conventional octave. It's more like the presence of something underneath rather than like a direct doubling of sound an octave down. And
rather than an effect, right?
Exactly. It's more just a great dub sound. So I don't really use that, but then it had the valve driver, which just cooks your preamp, which I found very usable and used all the time. And that's just an on-off with one rotary and then a compressor as well. And to be honest, if you're not like, if you were doing a session or playing at home or anything like that, then having control of that drive and that compressor is almost like those are your basic tones dealt with. There, but you know, for full gigs, I obviously wouldn't use the compressor. I'd have something on my board that was a bit more dynamic. They were very, very good. But then I started using the CTM 300, which is very much Ashdown's SVT, only sort of twice the weight and depth. It was the biggest, heaviest amplifier I have ever played. I decided to take it on tour because I played it and was like, this thing sounds so good. I think I have to take it on tour. And we had like 2 weeks in Europe and I was like, well, I obviously can't take it on tour as it is. I need to buy a flight case. But it was so big and it's so unusual. Like it's not, you know, it's not one of their big sellers that I had to have the flight case custom built. So I was like, cool. This has cost me £250 just to carry. and it was absolutely a two-man lift. My band hated me. A head that was a two-man lift.
I mean, nothing changed there.
Yeah.
No, of course. This is after I'd convinced my guitarist and my sax player, who also plays guitar, to move to Boss Katanas because they're lightweight and portable and easy to take on tour. I then turned up to that same tour with a two-man lift head, let alone let alone the two. I had Ashdown make me... They did two 15-inch cabs in 410 housings. So they're like oversized 15 inches. And I've got two of those in black mesh in black Tolex with red mesh. And they're cotton wool lined, just like the old Ampeg cabs were. But yeah, so you've got two of those plus a two-man lift.
Why don't they just kick you out of the band? Like, seriously.
I would when like the between two guitar players they brought less stuff. Even when our main guitarist Tim plays through two Boss Katanas and our sax player stroke guitarist has one Boss Katana, that was less gear than I was bringing on tour with two oversized 115s and a CTM 300 head.
It sounds like the katanas were sort of like your olive branch to the band. Please, please take my small offering in advance of the costs to all of our spinal health.
I tell you what, I do think the katana, the Boss Katana, sounds as good as any Valve amp. And I have lots of great guitar amplifiers, and I can genuinely say that I think the katana sounds absolutely as good as them.
Sure.
For guitar. I can't say that for bass. I'm using a CTM-300. I would love to not use a CTM-300. Mm-hmm. I would love for a Class D to be able to do for bass what a katana can do for a guitar. But I'm still constantly convinced that if you want to sound good as a bass player, if you want an old school sound, then a lot of the time you still need a massive valve head. That said, I do think both Eden and Aguilar, did I do that one right?
Yes. You did. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
offer some absolutely fantastic alternatives. I just haven't bought either of those brands.
That's the topic for next week. Then can we put together a rig that will outdo Joe's old school bass rig that doesn't require a flatbed truck to transport it?
A flatbed truck. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We should. Right, well, that does, in fact, bring us up to time on this, the first episode of the Bass Guitar Nerds. Thank you very much, listener, for tuning in to the first time ever that Guitar Nerds has done solely bass-related content. I've had a fantastic time talking about things that I actually care about rather than talking about things that you guys care about, dear listener. So yes, thank you for being a part of it.
The ultimate Joe Branton indulgence project.
Well, yes, thank you very much to Mark, JD and Naomi for being my co-hosts on this one. And yes, we'll be back next week in some form with more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.